1968, the year that saw Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy assassinated, Paris riot and the Prague Spring crushed, was also the year that saw the life of Thomas Merton brought to a tragic, untimely end. On the 10th of December, the monk and writer was in Bangkok at a conference of religious leaders. He delivered a talk on monasticism and Marxism.
I am addressing myself to the monk who is potentially open to contact with the intellectual, the university student, the university professor, and the people who are thinking along lines which are going to change both Western and Eastern society and create the world of the future in which inevitably we are going to have to make our adaptation.
Just a few hours after giving that lecture, Thomas Merton was dead, electrocuted in a hotel bathroom. He was 53. Four decades later, his challenging ideas about the spiritual life, about the nature of God, about war and peace and much else, continue to have a wide following through the over 100 books that he wrote and his published letters and journals and articles. For 27 years, almost exactly half of his life, he lived as a Trappist monk at the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky, eventually becoming a hermit in a little cabin in the grounds of the monastery. 27 years, the same length of time Nelson Mandela spent in jail. But where Mandela was deprived of his liberty, Merton described his confinement as entering the four walls of my new freedom. The Command of the Lord, sung by monks of the Abbey of Gethsemane. It's from an album of Christian and Buddhist chants and settings of Thomas Merton's writings, with an introduction by the Dalai Lama, who met Thomas Merton just 2 months before he died. The Tibetan spiritual leader later said of Merton that he'd been particularly struck by the inner life he manifested. "It was Merton," wrote the Dalai Lama, "who first introduced me to the real meaning of the word Christian." Thomas Merton acknowledged his debt to the Abbey of Gethsemane, not least in this poem, The Trappist Abbey, Matins, with its evocative blending of the monastery's physical and spiritual environment.
When the full fields begin to smell of sunrise, and the valleys sing in their sleep, the pilgrim moon pours over the solemn darkness her waterfalls of silence, and then departs up the long avenue of trees. The stars hide in the glade, their light like tears, and tremble where some train runs, lost, baying in eastward mysteries of distance, where fire flares somewhere over a sink of cities. Now kindle in the windows of this lady house, my soul, your childish clear awakeness. Burn in the country night your wise and sleepless lamp. For from the frowning tower, the windy belfry, sudden the bells come, bridegrooms, and fill the echoing dark with love and fear. Wake in the windows of Gethsemane, my soul, my sister, for the past years with smoky torches come, bringing betrayal from the burning world and bloodying the glade with pitch flame. Wake in the cloisters of the lonely night, my soul, my sister, where the apostles gather, who were one time scattered, and mourn God's blood in the place of his betrayal, and weep with Peter at the triple cock crow.
Perhaps it's a clue to his popularity that Thomas Merton was as much at home listening to this.
25 cents? No, I wouldn't pay 25 cents to go in nowhere. 'Cause listen here, up in Harlem every Saturday night when the highbrows get together is just too tight. They all congregate at an all-night strut. And what they do is tut, tut, tut. Oh, Hannah Brown from Crosstown gets full of corn and starts breaking them down. Just at the break of day, you can hear old Hannah say, give me a Bigfoot and a bottle of beer. Send me calls, I don't care. Play me calls, I don't care.
The great jazz singer Bessie Smith with the joyful Give Me a Pigfoot and a Bottle of Beer. Thomas Merton was a jazz lover all his life. In his autobiography, The Seven Story Mountain, he says that during his teenage years, he would go into music shops and listen to records, and then buy one in return for the privilege of listening to all the rest. He was born in France in 1915, his mother originally from America and his father from New Zealand. He had an itinerant upbringing in France and England and the United States. He had a somewhat infamously reckless existence studying at Cambridge and then a more successful one at Columbia University in New York. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, spoke at an event this week to commemorate the 40th anniversary of Thomas Merton's death. I went to see him in the chapel at Lambeth Palace and asked first what drew him to Merton.
What drew me first to him, I think, was the sheer intensity of the writing. I came across him when I was a teenager, when, of course, you respond to intense writing a bit, and read some of his early journals. When he first became a monk, and also his autobiography, the famous autobiography, in which he describes his long process of conversion and arriving at Roman Catholic faith and joining the monastery. And that excitement of the writing, the sense of someone discovering God and prayer with that level of excitement and that level of freshness and imagination in his language, I think that's what captured me first.
He experienced, of course, a good deal of sadness in his early life. He lost both his parents while he was young. Then comes a hedonistic lifestyle while he's studying at Cambridge, and he fathers a child. He's packed off to America, becomes a young communist, a Roman Catholic, and eventually a monk. Now, that's a pretty dramatic swing of the pendulum, if ever there was one. How would you say that all of that has shaped him and his spiritual thinking?
I think he remained all his life an orphan, somebody who was very conscious of not having a home. And some of the most poignant moments in the autobiography describe that sense of homelessness. Clearly, when he wrote his early works in the monastery, he felt he'd come home. The Catholic faith, the monastic life, this was it. And over the years, what happened, as I read it, is that he discovered he had to come home to himself and to God at another level. Hence the passionate quest for solitude within the monastery, which he had a lot of trouble with. But I think it's that next moment that becomes interesting. After about the mid-50s in his writing, he realizes that he can't just sit back in what he's arrived at, that it's somehow not getting to the deepest level.
He took to Catholicism very enthusiastically, we might say, mightn't we? It's been said of him that he replaced the doubts and uncertainties of his own past with the unquestioned and unquestioning certitude of the Roman Catholic Church in the mid-20th century. But then later we see him increasingly interested in and apparently attracted by Eastern spirituality and indeed promoting interfaith dialogue. What do you make of that progression, and where do you sense it might have led him had he lived longer?
I think you can see almost three waves of development in the mature Merton. First of all, he really, really discovers the early church, the great Greek fathers of the early church, and some of the modern Eastern Orthodox writers as well. And the slightly narrow, slightly kind of tribal Catholicism, which at first he's quite aggressively in favour of, that begins to soften. He sees that Christianity itself is a big room to live in. The next phase of that is, especially in the early 60s, discovering some of the great Protestant writers of the 20th century. He falls in love with Karl Barth and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, you know, the great prophets of resistance to Hitler, and the great prophets also of an attitude to Christianity which sees it as something quite different from just churchy interiority, something more than religion, but faith. And then the strange third step is towards interfaith dialogue. Strange because theologians like Karl Barth weren't at all interested in interfaith dialogue, but something has loosened up, something has released him to listen for the word of God wherever it comes. And I think that's what drives him to this very receptive, very positive engagement with non-Christian faiths. Now, where he would have got to is anybody's guess. I'm not one of those who thinks that he would just have thrown over his Catholicism. It's too deep. He really is a Christian. He really believes that God is the Holy Trinity, that the Son became incarnate in Jesus Christ. No doubt about that. He carries on with that. And he's a bit like Dietrich Bonhoeffer in his last years in prison. People say Bonhoeffer in his last days is going beyond Orthodox Christianity, Merton in his last days. I don't think that's true of either of them. But they've got to a level where the tribal reactions have disappeared. There's a security in the depth that allows them to experiment on the frontiers.
We're talking in the chapel here at Lambeth Palace, a place of prayer and praise. Now, both prayer and praise seem to be absolutely central to Thomas Merton's faith. Now, what is it of him that comes particularly to your mind while you're here in the chapel?
Exactly that sense of something rising up. He writes sometimes about his experience, both in the monastery and as a hermit, of the dawn. And I think the first section of one of his books is called The Night Spirit and the Dawn Air. And for some reason, that image has stayed with me for over 40 years now, as an image of what happens when you begin to pray. A night spirit, darkness and the dawn air, the scent of something different in silence, that very silent moment of dawn.
Thomas Merton, as you say, chose a religious order where silence and solitude are central to the way of life, and yet he clearly remained very engaged with the big issues of the day, the Vietnam War, worries about nuclear warfare and so on, and he keeps up a very active correspondence with many people outside the monastery. And for good measure, he falls in love with a student nurse after having an operation. Do you feel that he achieved a balance and accommodation between the many different dimensions of his life, or that there really were very significant tensions there?
I think there are unresolved tensions. I think that sense of homelessness that I mentioned earlier is real for him right up to the end, and the very complex relationship with the student nurse in the last couple of years just illustrates the unresolved emotional needs, I think. And you can see sometimes in his letters this desperate urge to belong. He wants to speak the language of the people he's writing to. So you can read a letter he wrote to, let's say, a Sufi master in the Middle East on one page, and you can read a letter he wrote to a teenager in California on the next page. And they're utterly, utterly different. He tries to get into the language of each of them, as if to say, I'm like you really, I relate to you. And that's impressive at one level, slightly sad at another level. You feel he's struggling a bit. And so, no, it's not a story of wisdom achieved and stability guaranteed. It's a story of a man who's still really searching, and yet there is something in the depths which has anchored him and held him.
He wrote of the desirability of achieving a serene carelessness, and yet he also in many ways seems a very self-centered and self-absorbed person. Another contradiction there?
Yes, I think it's one of the things that some people find most difficult in his writing. He's absolutely fascinated by Thomas Merton. And what saves it from being just self-absorbed, I think, is the deep self-critical element that there is in it. You've read a page of what seems to be rambling, self-indulgent reflection, and you think, oh, this is impossible. And you turn the page, and he says, I've been rambling and self-indulgent. And all the time you think, yes, he's there before you. He knows the problems. He's honest.
Archbishop Rowan Williams. It may indeed be that honesty that's drawn so many people to Merton's writings. His words have captured the imagination of songwriters and singers, Kate Campbell one of them. These lines from Thoughts in Solitude have become known as the Merton Prayer.
My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think that I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you.
Solitude for Thomas Merton took him eventually to the point of living as a hermit. Before that, he was responsible for the development of the monks. This rather grainy recording is from his last talk to the novices before going to live in the hermitage.
A person doesn't go into solitude simply to practice a lot of virtues, see. If that's what's supposed to be happening, I'm probably not going to be able to make the grade. But you go into solitude in order to cast your care upon the Lord. Let me read this couple of sentences from Kosad, which give the whole essence of it. First of all, self-abandonment, which is, this is what we're here for, see, this business of surrendering totally to God. Self-abandonment is that continual forgetfulness of self, which leaves the soul free to eternally love God, untroubled by those fears, reflections, regrets, and anxieties which the care of one's own perfection and salvation gives. Now, what he's saying there, he is accusing monks, actually, of what we do. We come from the world and we leave behind worldly cares, and we come into a little world of the monastery which is full of its little cares of its own. See, the trouble with the monastic life is that it's supposed to be a life without care, and we have filled it with care. We are devoured by care. See, care about our job, care about our life of prayer, care about how we're getting on, this constant business. Do you deny that our life is a life of care? Well, then do you deny that we're constantly, constantly going over, reflecting, reflecting? He said this, and he made this sign, and I made this sign, and next time I'm going to make this sign, and he'll drop dead, because it's going to be a real fine. It's going to get a cross. And this is care, see? And what we are here for is to get rid of that. And, of course, you get rid of it by going through it.
But Thomas Merton and, indeed, his superiors wanted the profound spiritual experiences of the monastery to be shared by all. 8 months before he died, Merton wrote for students at the University of Louisville, Kentucky. He asked his readers to imagine what he called creative silence. People in a quiet place where no radio, no background music can be heard, and who simply sit in silence for half an hour or an hour, no books in their hands, not busy with anything, wanting to pray not with their lips, but with their hearts, and, he said, with the very ground of their being.
What would prompt modern people to do such a thing? Are they moved by a sense of human need for silence, for reflection, for inner seeking? Do they want to get away from the noise and tension of modern life, at least for a little while, in order to relax their minds and wills, and seek a blessed healing sense of inner unity, reconciliation, integration? These are certainly good enough motives. But for a Christian, there are even deeper motives than this. A Christian can realize himself called by God to periods of silence, reflection, meditation, and listening. We are perhaps too talkative, too activistic in our conception of the Christian life. Our service of God and of the Church does not consist only in talking and doing. It can also consist in periods of silence, listening, waiting. Perhaps it is very important, in our era of violence and unrest, to rediscover meditation, silent inner unitive prayer, and creative Christian silence. Silence has many dimensions. It can be a regression and an escape, a loss of self, or it can be presence, awareness, unification, self-discovery. Negative silence blurs and confuses our identity, and we lapse into daydreams or diffuse anxieties. Positive silence pulls us together and makes us realize who we are, who we might be, and the distance between these two.
Compassion, Thomas Merton wrote, teaches me that my brother and I are one. If I love my brother, then my love benefits my own life as well. If I hate my brother and seek to destroy him, I seek to destroy myself also. And contemplation, he said, the hallmark of the monastic existence, is life itself. Merton said that in contemplating, we know by unknowing, or better, we know beyond all knowing or unknowing. I asked Archbishop Rowan Williams,
how do you personally define his legacy? Do you think he really can be called, as he often is, one of the most influential spiritual writers of the 20th century?
I think he can be called a deeply influential spiritual writer, certainly one of the great figures of the century in that way. What he does is to open doors in different directions for the rest of us. He, if you like, represents the possibility of holding together very precariously, but very importantly, the deep legacy of Christian doctrine and devotion and liturgy, openness to the cultural, the imaginative life of his own society, openness to other faiths, and that's a place where many people really feel they would like to live. And he begins to clear that space in the forest, as you might say. He doesn't settle it all, he doesn't solve the problems, but that, I think, is what people find so animating, so vivifying about him.
Rowan Williams. In his book Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, Thomas Merton explains how he would define God.
At the centre of our being is a point of nothingness which is untouched by sin and by illusion, a point of pure truth, a point or spark which belongs entirely to God, which is never at our disposal, from which God disposes of our lives, which is inaccessible to the fantasies of our own mind or the brutalities of our own will. This little point of nothingness and of absolute poverty is the pure glory of God in us. It is, so to speak, his name written in us, as our poverty, as our indigence, as our dependence, as our sonship. It is like a pure diamond blazing with the invisible light of heaven. It is in everybody, and if we could see it, we would see these billions of points of light coming together in the face and blaze of a sun that would make all the darkness and cruelty of life vanish completely. I have no program for this seeing. It is only given. But the gate of heaven is everywhere.
Thomas Merton shared with the composer Edmund Rubra an admiration for the 16th century Spanish mystic St. John of the Cross, who's been called a man with a strong sense of the spiritual expressed through the sensual. Rubra set St. John's Song of the Soul in intimate communication and union with the love of God to music. The composer called the song an image of earthly love and of the rapture of attainment when the soul has finally ceased its earthly struggles through the dark night. It's not hard to imagine Thomas Merton enjoying this.